is Pam Freeman, and I'm an alcoholic. Oh, wow. I love this room. I've been visiting you young people for over 10 years, and there's so much energy. You're really good to me, and I really like that. But what you do is you give me so much hope. I have three sons, and they all three have the illness of alcoholism. And so I know if you guys can do it, because I remember when some of you got here that they can do it too. And it just really just energizes me and gives me the hope. My youngest son, he's 30, and I know I don't look old enough to have a 30-year-old, but June 2nd, I was getting texts from him, and the Mexican mafia was after him. And I texted him back, and I said, "Troy, go to a meeting." And he's like, texting me back, "A meeting's not going to help this." So anyway, long story short, he did end up in a crisis unit, and he's in AA today, and the Mexican mafia has left him alone. So you know, this thing does work. And, you know, he's 30, and he's been trying to get sober since he was 14. And, you know, alcoholism is cunning, baffling, and powerful. And I cannot even imagine I was 40 before I got sober, you know, and I could not imagine your age and even thinking that I needed help from anything. So thank you, every one of you, for your sobriety, because you do feed my spirit. I talk about you all the time in Polk County, and every young person I run into, I tell them about all of you. And you've got to go to Tampa. You've got to see these young people in Tampa. The energy and the spirituality is just tremendous. And you guys are a fine example of what Alcoholics Anonymous is. And so I guess I'll talk about me now. That's right. That's the fun part. Thank you for inviting me to speak. I don't even know where to start. I'll just start with the first drunk that I remember. And I was maybe, who knows how old I was. I don't know, 13, 14 years old. That was a while back. And what happened was, what I know is I had something really wrong with me way before I got a drink. I probably needed a drink for a really long time before I got one. Because from my earliest memory, you all owed me something. I mean, I can remember this as a kid, that you owed me something, you needed to do something for me, and you needed to know what that was, because I sure as heck didn't know how to tell you what it was. And I can remember my family members finding me in a corner somewhere crying, and they go, "What's wrong with you?" And I didn't know. Absolutely did not. And the gentleman that spoke before, you know, he mentioned that idea that, you know, there's not enough for us. I mean, there is never enough. There was never enough alcohol. There is never enough of the drugs. And there was never enough anything. And even sober, there's not enough. That's why we have to give it back. That's why God's made this the way this was, because you can't please an alcoholic. I don't know if you guys have figured that out yet or not. But we have to, you know, keep giving it back, and we have to keep an old-timer from Polk County, Faye Beck. She talks about God's in the seeking, see, and we have to keep seeking, because there isn't enough for us, and we want more, and we want more, and we want more. And you know, Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me to want more good, more God, and more positive. So that first drunk I remember, what happened was I blacked out. I puked. I mean, alcoholism's ugly, and that's what we do. We puke, and I relieved myself in inappropriate places. It started off right off the bat, and my alcohol, my drunkalog. That's it. The alcoholism, it never got any different. I would drink till blackout, get sick, and I'm surprised I didn't go to jail for indecent exposure, the way I would, you know, just relieve myself anywhere. I was crazy is what I was. So anyway, what happened, though, was my memory of that was that was the first time I got any relief from me. And after that moment, I sought alcohol. I hadn't got to the drugs yet because I believed some reason I held off for a few years on that until I was 16. But but the alcohol I loved, and there were severe consequences for that first drunk. Restrictions, and my mother was a beater, and there was just severe consequences for that. But I still went for it anyway. It was something had been unleashed in me, and it was 40 before it started, some discipline, and it started to reel in. So what happened was, I met my first husband. I was 17, and oh gosh, most of the time when you get married, you kind of like date and decide whether you like them or not, if you have something in common, that type thing. And I just didn't do that. Yeah, I mean, my criteria was if they stayed, and that was it. And then I would have moments of clarity. I'd get pregnant, and then I'd think, oh, I don't like this. I need to go. And I would leave. And so the first son, Rod, this beautiful blue-eyed, blonde-haired boy, and I left his, divorced his dad when he was a year old and went to work in bars. I was 18 years old, and drinking age was 18 here in Florida then, and went to work in the bar and found the substance that lets you go 24 hours and you can drink. And I was a workaholic, too. So, I mean, it really suited my lifestyle, to where I could work and drink and party. And I had this kid, and I was always telling him to hurry up because I'm going. I am just going. I don't know where I'm going, but I'm going. And hurry up, Rod. Hurry up. Come on. And I never did teach this kid anything, how to tie his shoes. I never read stories to him. There was no discipline or structure in our home. It was crazy. I worked in child welfare for about 7 years, and boy, I got to see me over and over and over again, because when you're living that lifestyle, you don't clean house. It was awful when I think about it. It was really dark and ugly. And some of it, I think when we're doing the reason the fifth step's meant to be done in private, because I think we shouldn't harm people by giving them ugly pictures, of us, because we have to keep looking at each other in the eye. So, but it was just, it was ugly. And alcoholism and good parent just does not fit in the same picture frame. No matter how you do it, you can't make it fit. It doesn't fit. And this kid started school, and he didn't know anything. And my perception was he was getting me in trouble. And because I was always getting called to the school over him. And the result of that, there was some physical abuse that went on. And this is self-centeredness, in its ugliest form, that had this child. And I didn't, my alcoholism, abused him. And the ninth step has helped heal all that. But that's the reality. That's the truth. Alcoholism is ugly. You are so fortunate to be in recovery at this point. Because I raised all three sons with alcoholism. But this is interesting. A friend of mine, she's in recovery. She raised her children sober. And when my son was in the crisis unit, her daughter was in the crisis unit. And I'm thinking, where's my guilt at? But anyway, so alcoholism does what it does regardless of your environment is the message I'm saying. So I met my second husband, and he was a mean little man, is what he was. And he drank like I drank. And, oh, man. I don't advocate domestic violence at all. I really don't. In fact, I'm a victim. I've been a victim's advocate, whatever. But there's this thing called mutual consent between two alcoholics. And when they've got you by the hair of the head, and they're saying, I love you, I love you, I love you, it's like, that's love, and this went on for years, and I was not a victim. Don't get me wrong. He needed to be afraid. Because I was harmed in childhood quite a bit. So I was angry, hurt people, and I was very angry, and I was going to get you before you got me, and I was redneck on top of it. And so we had two beautiful blue-eyed, blonde-haired boys also, Justice and Troy. And, well, first, wait, he went to prison not long after we were together, he was gone for 18 months, and you know what? That was the best relationship I've had to this day, I'm telling you. Because, you know, the long-distance thing, you know, and when they're in jail, those jailhouse romances, you know, you write letters, and I love you, and this and that, and it's all, you know, it just fits the alcoholic delusion, you know what I'm saying? And you don't have to cook, clean, wash laundry, you don't have to do anything. You just go to the visiting park, you know, and visit. And we know what goes on when you visit. But anyway... I almost said it, but I didn't. But anyway, like I said, it was love, and you know what? You cannot kill love under any circumstances. So anyway, he come home, and that's when the violence started with us, and it was real ugly. So he wasn't home long, and I was pregnant with my third son, and he got a DUI. We were all together on a family outing about midnight, you know. My poor, no wonder they drink. They're doing what they were raised to do. But this was back when the DUI laws really became strict. And before that, you could pay a fine. It was like, there wasn't really heavy consequence. But this was consequence here. And he was looking at going back to jail. And you know it's love. And so we were living in Winter Haven, Florida, and couldn't let him take my man to jail. And so he was born in California, and he'd been telling me about California, golden land of opportunity, and the pay scale was great, and financially our lives were going to be way better when we, you know, if we could only get to California. So with him facing jail and possible prison again, we had a yard sale and moved to California. And you just have to picture this. I like giving visuals. But we had like a 62 Chevrolet that was primed out gray primer paint. And then we'd put a topper on it. And we loaded all our belongings and two kids. And Troy, I was pregnant with Troy. And here we hit the road. And we looked like the Beverly Hillbillies. I mean, everything was just piled so high. And I don't know why. He did not work here in Florida. I don't know what made me think he would work in California. I don't know. But and what happened was we lived in abject. Is that right? The right word? Poverty. There's no other word for it. I mean, it was we lived in a little 12-by-18 cabin, no electricity. We were pioneers, is what we were, and you know, we had gravity flow water and gas refrigerator. I mean, we got along okay. But we drank is what we did, and we drank. And the violence, you know, it's research indicates that in violent relationships, eventually it will move on to the children. And there's a lot of men in prison who killed the men that were abusing their mothers. And that oldest son of mine, he was 7, and he had begun to try to protect me. So somehow or another, I had a moment of clarity and was able to leave that relationship. And what happened to me, I was 28, 29 years old, and this was in Joshua Tree, California, and I moved to town. There wasn't even a red light in this little town. It was at the entrance of Joshua Tree Monument, where a lot of rock climbing goes on. Internationally, it's known for this. And went to work in this little tiny restaurant and met these people, and they liked to drink, liked to smoke a little weed, partied. But they didn't drink like I did. And what happened to me, these people actually, when they invited you over for a barbecue, they actually ate, you know, and didn't do what active alcoholics do. And I became acutely aware of what I had become. And I was very ashamed of the drunk woman that I was. So I made a decision to quit drinking. And I went on the marijuana maintenance plan, and... God, it was awful. It was so difficult, you know, and it was like one day I just did not drink. And I had this kid, he wouldn't behave. And I'm going to tell you something about untreated alcoholism. Alcoholism demands treatment. Either you have to have the alcohol or you got to have the 12 steps. And if you don't have either one of those, alcoholism is at its finest. That is when it's the strongest. Alcohol was not my problem. It was my solution. It was God's grace I found alcohol so I could stay alive long enough to make it to Alcoholics Anonymous. And so anyway, I'm crazy. And so I go to the doctor, and I have some borderline tendencies, and they're the step seven is pretty well taken care of. It takes about 15 years or more, but they were real strong initially. But anyway, this doctor, I go in and I'm like, and he knew my whole life story in 5 minutes. And one of the things I told him was I used to drink, and Bud Light's calling me back, and you know, and I was desperate because that restless, irritable, discontented thing, you know. So what he did is he suggested I go to church, and he prescribed me benzodiazepine. And so I followed the doctor's orders. I went to church, and he just made the mistake of telling me where he went to church. And I had this little white Volkswagen. It was a dune buggy. It had been, I don't know what the right word is, but it had been adjusted to go in the mountains, dune buggy. And it had some carburetor issues. And it was real loud. And when you slowed down at a red light or any time you wanted to slow down, it would want to stall out. So you'd have to like, rawr, 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 keep it revved up. And then when you would turn the key off, it would go, boom, it'd backfire like that. So here we go. I found the church. And I had the three boys, and we're in the Volkswagen. So when I slow down to turn the parking lot, I've got it revved up, rawr, 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 like that. And then we get in, and I turn it off. It goes, boom, backfires like this. And there's a group of people in the parking lot, and my kids, they don't use doors. They crawl out windows, you know, and it's like, and I'm borderline personality, screaming like a washerwoman, you know, get over here, stop it. I said, stop it, get over here now, Troy. I said, get here, you know, and just making this huge scene, turned around, everybody's gone. They're gone, and there's, except for one little man, and he helped us find our place to go. I'm going to make a very long story short. Number one. And this isn't anything against religion. I so honor Alcoholics Anonymous's attitude towards a higher power, your own conception of a higher power. So this is just my experience. And so this isn't against religion. This is just me in it. Okay? Religion's fine. Religion is okay. This is Pam Freeman in it, what I'm going to talk about. So untreated alcoholism can hide out in religion. And I was not attracted to the people that were sitting getting the message, the living, basic living skills, and there's a good message there, right? Now, I wasn't attracted to that. I was attracted to this little underground group. Anyway, long story short, what it got me was they diagnosed me with demon possession. It made perfect sense. It really did, you know, because, well, I kept drinking. You know, I got baptized and I kept drinking, and I kept going to church and I kept drinking. And so demon possession made perfect sense. And Mary Shaw told me at 2 years sober, I was telling my story, and she said, you know, that's a perfect setup for an alcoholic, because I didn't have to take any responsibility for my behavior or the drinking or anything. It was the demons. And went through a lot of exorcisms, even exorcised myself, okay, and they kept coming back because I kept drinking, and they kept coming back. This went on for 11 years, and it was a terrible, terrible, terrible place to be, because, see, I bought into the idea that God was the solution. I had had no religious training in my upbringing. It was just a lot of abuse and a lot of . And so I knew God was the solution, but I had a very, very distorted idea of what that was supposed to look like. And so the ideas that I got was, if I could read enough spiritual information, if I could stay on my knees enough, if I could clean up enough, then I can present myself to God. And I also had this idea, that little pixie dust idea, that if these exorcisms would work and these demons would go, then I'm going to be okay. See? Well, they never went, and I kept drinking, and I moved to Florida, and the people that knew about the demons were in California, the ones that did the exorcisms and stuff like this. So I'm here stuck with just exercising myself and drinking, and met my third husband, and he was a tall man. He wasn't a little mean man. He was a tall man, but he wouldn't let me hit him. You know what I'm saying? He was almost 7 foot tall, and I'd go to sway, and he'd put his hand on my forehead just like that, and I couldn't reach him, you know? And he'd also, I think he'd poke at me, you know what I mean, just to get me there, you know, and then laugh at me. I abused that man terribly, emotionally, and never could physically. He wouldn't let me, but I would have. But the way I'd get him back, because he wouldn't let me do it the way I thought I needed to do it. But he loved to eat, and I'm a good cook. And he'd make me mad, and I couldn't win that argument. And I'd take that food, and I'd throw it out the back door, and he'd shut up. Now, the dogs, they got where when they'd hear the voices raised, their tails would start wagging. they'd beat it to that back door because they knew something was coming. And the kids would start ordering takeout because they knew I was going to win. I was going to be right. And God loved that man. He left me for a woman who didn't drink. And that didn't set well with me then, and it still don't set too well with me. So anyway, so he left me. And then the next year was the, I mean, by now I'm almost 40. I'm 39. And it was really bad. Yeah, I mean, it was... And I always thought that I was a good mom. I mean, it got to the point where I couldn't take care of my kids. And, well, the oldest one, he was 21. It was probably time for him to get out of the nest anyway. But the other two, the 14-year-old, Justice, I didn't know where he went until a couple of years ago, and I got to do a night step with that. He was drunk, and he wouldn't go to Taco Bell at 2 o'clock in the morning. So I said, will this make up for that little, you know, thing? And he said, yeah, Mom. But, I didn't know where he went. He just kind of hit the streets, take care of himself. And then the youngest one, Troy, I took him to his dad and dumped him off and gave his dad a bottle of benzodiazepine and went crazy. And, you know, I dated bikers when in my 20s, and this kind of shows the progression of alcoholism because in my 20s, I could get a biker with a bike and a last name. And in the 40s, it don't work quite that well. I couldn't get a biker with a bike. I mean, it was in last names. I don't eat gypsy and pirate, the one-armed biker, you know. And I must have been. When I think about riding that Harley with one-armed biker, it scares the hell out of me today. But it sure didn't then. But anyway, and it had gotten really bad. And I'm a workaholic. I had two jobs. I would party till 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, go to work at 6, and I was real skinny, like Ethiopian skinny, you know, like you don't have any access to food, and you know, and I was flat chested, you know, and this is recovery here, I'm telling you. You know, so anyway, you know, I was dying, you know, and my supervisor at the time, I was working at this restaurant, and she was blonde, she was pretty, her fingernails were long and they were clean, she dressed real pretty, and she told me about herself. This is real important too. She told me a little bit about, I'm getting in recovery now. She told me a little bit about herself, and she had drank. I don't think she drank like I did, but she drank, and she was in Alcoholics Anonymous, and she left me alone. And so I watched her for 9 months while I drank. She was the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous for me at that time, because what I could see was her life was working for her, and there must be something in Alcoholics Anonymous working. So when I finally hit my bottom, and I don't know how you surrender, I don't know. I just just know there came the time when finally, of course, I'd been trying not to drink for 11 years, and the demons were trying to kill me because I had the benzos. I kept them in my pocket, the sedatives that they talk about in the big book that a lot of us alcoholics end up on. Counted those pills all the time, but I had kids who ripped my stuff off, so I needed to. And counted them because I had to have them to work, and then until I could get off work and drink. And the demons were telling me, take the whole bottle, take the whole bottle. I know that's suicidal ideation now, but then I thought it was demons. And would strongly consider it some nights, you know. And would call those people in California, and see that those people in that religion are so precious to me today, because I know it was their prayers that kept me alive and got me in AA. So finally I made it to Alcoholics Anonymous, and what happened to me then was I fell into a group of some no-nonsense women. They were not interested in my inner child, not one little bit. They expected me to sit down and behave. And they never told me that. I just intuitively knew to do that. You know, I didn't breathe for 2 years. Some of you know Mary Lyons, and there used to be just a group of Marys. A lot of our old timers have passed away, but at one time in Polk County, there was up to like six women in their 70s and 80s and knew how to stay sober and knew how to get a life in Alcoholics Anonymous. So my first sponsor, I had four that first year. I think that's kind of common. I've had the same one for 16 years now. But a brief little interlude when a very good friend of mine, I fired my sponsor of 10 years and decided I was smarter. And then my friend kept me propped up for a couple of months till I realized I had made a mistake. But there's something to be said for longevity in relationship with sponsor and sponsee. Something, I mean, I don't have to catch her up on anything. She knows me, and that's real helpful. But anyway, what happened is the one of the first sponsors I had that first year, she took me through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we did the academic work, you know, the reading and the inventories that type thing, listened to Joe and Charlie, and just did a lot of things. I didn't really get a whole lot out of that, I'll be honest with you. And what I later came to learn is that this Alcoholics Anonymous is not an academic exercise. It's not a mechanical thing. It's a spiritual process, and there's so much value in that get in the car and shut up principle that we have. You know. Because I started getting better. I needed to read the book, don't get me wrong. I needed to do all that. There's nothing wrong with that. But if I had to get in the car, I had to start going out to eat with these women, I had to start going to conferences with these women, I had to start going to their houses, I had to call them so I could learn how to use the steps. I think the first speaker, he talked about working them. See, I'd been working something for 11 years, trying. But see, God ain't that way. I have no power. God's going to do this deal. And Mary Shaw in Lakeland, what she says is eventually the steps take you, you know? And that's what's happened in my life now. The steps have me. You know, first 5 or 6 years, we kind of take our emotional temperature all the time. Oh, God, what step am I on? I need to do a six. I need to do, you know. But eventually that does go away. And it just works, and it's smooth. And when you teach other people, you know, it's always in hindsight that I realize what God did and where I was at. But it took a while to get it. So, you know, I'm just really strong on the relationship piece of this program. You know, in this Living Sober book, there's a phrase in there somewhere. It talks about the most, and I don't know if it says this, I read it drinking, but so anyway, but this is what my perception of what it says. And yeah, anyway, the most important conversations that I ever had were with me. It was up here. I was so locked in and so stuck. I mean, I talked a lot. I was a party girl, joke teller. You know, I was the life of the party, but nobody ever knew who Pam was, you know. And the first, once I made that first declaration of my name is Pam Freeman and I am an alcoholic, then it was on. That was the first honest thing I'd ever said out loud about who this woman was. You know? And so Alcoholics Anonymous and being with these women have freed me of that. I'm not stuck in my head anymore. I'm out here all over the place, maybe too much sometimes, but it's freedom. So I strongly support the sponsorship idea and making ourselves accountable. I was a very undisciplined woman, and I needed some discipline. And one of the ways that I would behave, I remember once I had a job, I was worked in the jail, and wasn't behaving myself very well with my peers, and I had to start pretending like my sponsor was right there with me so I'd stop, you know. I didn't get here and get well. I just got better a little bit over time. But anyway, I want to talk about my sons just for a moment. Just, you know, because the power of Alcoholics Anonymous and the power of the program, and, you know, alcoholism's ugly, and raising children and being married, and, you know, anyone that, you know, that has anything to do with us, we've harmed in some way, you know. And thank God that what Alcoholics Anonymous did was give me the opportunity to fix that so I can stand toe-to-toe. And there was a point in the ninth step process that I used to think the ninth step was for them, that somehow it was me getting better and me changing and me not raging and me being kind and loving and a good mom would help them but or heal them, but it doesn't. It healed me, you know, and that's such valuable information. Once I understood that the ninth step was mine, not theirs, and I have to wait till they decide to get sober to address my alcohol, the effects of my alcoholism, and on that. How much time have I got? Seven minutes. Okay, what do I want to talk about? Wow, I have. I want to talk about, what do I want to talk about? I have so much. No, I do. I have so much to tell, especially with that ninth step. I don't know what to talk about. All right, give me a story here, God. I'm going to talk about the mean little man. I'm going to talk about him for a minute. No, because he hated me for years and years. We hated each other for years and years and years. And he was, just as my middle son was in prison a lot, over a, I don't know how long, 14-year period, something like that. He was incarcerated most of that time from 14, 15 till 3 years ago. And this will give you an idea how simple the ninth step is and how quickly God works when it's time to heal something. But this man absolutely hated me and accused me of flushing his dentures down the toilet for years. I didn't do it. Swear I didn't do it. But that was my legacy to the relationship. You know, he'd get drunk and tell everybody what I did. So, but I didn't do it. And my older son finally fessed up. He was the one. But anyway, but he hated me. He absolutely hated me, and I hated him. And when I got sober, one of my biggest fears was that he would come into an AA room where I was. I mean, I was so ashamed of all that, and it was so ugly. And the process of this process was incredible. And so what happened was, Justice is in prison. His mother calls. They want to go with me to see Justice in prison. It's his 21st birthday, and I wanted to go visit him. And so at first I told them they could follow me. I wasn't going to ride with that mean little man anywhere, right? And it's a 4-hour drive. Prisons are always 4 hours away when you have a loved one locked up. And I've experienced that several times, so I'm an expert on that. My whole family portrait album's on DOC website, okay? So I don't have to spend money in that area at all. It's just the state took care of it. But anyway, So finally I told him on the phone, meet me at the Shell station, you can follow me. Well, God got a hold of me before I got to the Shell station, and I invited them to ride with me. And what happened, it was magical. We found points of affection, because there was good in our relationship, and there was good in raising the kids, and we both loved those boys just desperately. And so we kind of connected that a little bit. Well, we got to the prison. someone went and told Justice, your mom and dad's here. And Justice, like, no way, that they're here together. Well, we were, and we got to buy him, we bought ice cream and donuts and sang happy birthday and spent the day, you know, having a birthday party with my son. And Justice later wrote me and said that's the best party he'd ever had. Then we left the prison, you know, and it was me, little mean man, and his mother. And we get outside the gate, the barbed wire, and we turn around and we're looking. And we have our arms around each other, you know, and we're sobbing. And I thought, my God, this man loves my son as much as I do. How can I be mad at him? And all of a sudden, it was all gone. I wasn't mad. I got God bumps now thinking about it. So we get in the car, and he said, baby, I need a drink. He called me baby. I hated it. He said, baby, I need a drink. And I'm thinking, then I thought, this man was hungover all day. He was sick. All, you know, that alcohol sick we get. He had suffered to be with his son, and I gained this much respect for him. How much? I mean, that is love, right? So he said, I said, okay. I says, I'll stop. As soon as I see a package store, I'll stop. And so I seen one. We're in the middle of the woods, and I seen one, and I whipped in. He goes, damn. He says, you saw it before I did. And I said, well, some things never change. You know, we have a sonar for that. And so he went in to buy his pint, and I just prayed, God, please don't let him call me baby all the way back home. And the man, he smoked and he drank all the way back. But anyway, the point of the story is I was not angry at him anymore. Fast forward a few more years. And all of a sudden, I'd inherited this home of my mom's, and I decided to remodel it. And he's, you know, master carpenter type person that is very, very messed up on pain pills and alcohol. But he was able to supervise my sons and really do a good job for me. And he'd get drunk and look at me and tell me how much he loved me. But what he got to do was he got to make amends to his son. See, he had never bought a birthday present, Christmas present, anything like that. All of a sudden, he was. All of a sudden, he came to a baby shower. Drunk and high, but all of a sudden, he was in relationship with us all. Well, he got very, very ill and put in the hospital on life support. And because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was able to help him die. And I was able to help my sons help their father die. And I'm so grateful for that because I hated this man. I mean, it was the fire hate. You know, it was punch you hate, you know. And it was gone, and it was love, and it was sweet. And, you know, that's the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. It helps us get okay with us because it wasn't ever him I was mad at. It was me I was mad at, you know. And anytime I have an issue with you, it's not you, it's me. And what a gift to know that. And I'm just going to close with what Sandy Beach says. And I know you guys say this all the time. I mean, hear him all the time. But I just love this idea. But, you know, when I'm disturbed, there's only one or two things to do, you know, make an amends or forgive them, you know. And thank God for Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God for all of you. I love you.